welcome to SciShow Tangents, the lightly competitive knowledge showcase starring some of the geniuses that make the YouTube series SciShow happen. This week, as always, I'm joined by Stefan Chen.
I've joined you.
What's your favorite season?
Summer.
Is
the
it?
The one that California is all the time.
Just as much hot as it can be.
I'm yeah. Hot and dry.
What's your tagline?
All them canned goods.
Oh, all of them. That's the way to go right now. Sam Schultz is here as well. What's the best grid pattern for planting plants in Animal Crossing New Horizons?
Oh, well, you know what? Sari just forwarded me a very interesting link. 5x5. It's more complicated than that. I won't get into it, but...
Okay. And what's your tagline?
Well, it was going to be 5x5 flower grid. You kind of ruined it for me.
Oh, sorry. Sari Riley is here as well. Sari, who is the Tiger King?
Oh, I don't know. He's like a man with a bleach blonde hair and mustache. I have avoided watching The Tiger King, so
it's probably for the best.
Yeah, anything that I know about him is just myth and legend, and it seems like the show is so wild that you could tell me anything, and I'd be like, sure, that happened. Like, a man played a kazoo and rode a tiger around.
Yeah.
And I'd be like, yes, that's the premise of The Tiger King.
Sari, what's your tagline?
Marshmallow surprise.
And I'm Hank Green, and my tagline is 10,000 wipes. Every week here on SciShow Tangents, we get together to try to one-up, amaze, and delight each other with science facts. We're playing for glory, and we're also keeping score and awarding sandbucks. From week to week, we do everything we can to stay on topic, but we're not great at that. So if you go on a tangent and the rest of the team deems that tangent unworthy, we'll force you to give up one of your sandbucks. So tangent with care. Now, as always, we introduce this week's topic with a traditional science poem, this week from Sari.
Flashing lights, whirring motors, two legs made of steel, an unfathomable head with sensors concealed. What powerful feats this metal beast might complete. Oh, it just did a backflip. That's freaking sweet. We imagine our bodies, our movements, our thoughts, wrapped up in circuitry and made into mascots. But that concept, dear humans, is inherently fraught because robots are not exactly what we were taught. Snake-like tubes or big welding arms, watering farms or sounding alarms, little vacuums that clean while doing no harm. Even soft robotic prosthetics have their own charm. Whether a machine is uncanny or a chunky space probe, the size of an elephant or a tiny microbe, one thing rings true in every scientist's heart: we'll never stop programming robots to fart.
Who's the farting robot?
I didn't know about this either.
There is a thing called the robot. It is an interactive farting figurine by Wowie. It's available at GameStop and Walmart.
This is really interesting because I also found a robot, same name, but it's used by Ford to test out car seats. And so it sits like a human male would in a car seat, and it's like sweaty and just is like a butt that sits on car seats.
Does it communicate its own comfort to you?
No, I think it like is to simulate wear and tear on the car seat over years because people are trading in their cars for new cars less often.
Right.
It's about the impact on the seat, not the impact on the butt.
Yes.
I'm willing to take that job and sit on a seat 100,000 times.
Yeah, this is why they gave that job to a robot, Stefan. They can't afford you. Sari, what is a butt? I mean, what is a robot?
Well, a robot, like a butt, has an impact on the physical world around us. And so, like a computer program that stays contained within a machine and does calculations, that's not a robot. But if it can interact with the physical world, I think
What about like a CD player then? Because it like spins a CD. I guess that's a kind of a robot.
Yeah, I guess kind of. It seems like scientists don't have a distinct definition of a robot. The Robot Institute of America says it's a reprogrammable, multifunctional manipulator designed to move material, parts, tools, or specialized devices through various programmed motions for the performance of a variety of tasks. So, like, a CD player fits into that, maybe.
Yeah.
Well, what's the difference between a robot and a machine?
I think robot starts to get at, like we've been talking about, doing tasks. So, like, a machine is like a toaster that you have to manipulate yourself. So, you have to be the human finger to push down the toaster button. But a robot toaster would, like, grab the bread for you and stick it in and then go, and then pop it back up. And you would have to do nothing. Like, it would replace you, so you wouldn't be necessary in the toast-making process anymore.
Okay.
Yeah, I feel like we sort of had the idea of what a robot was before we had robots. So it's like, well, a robot is a machine that does human things and looks human and acts human, but like can do more than a human can, physically at least.
Like making
and then
toast.
We were like, yeah. And then we were like, but actually we're going to have real robots, but they're not going to fulfill a lot of those categories because most robots do not look anything like people because their goal isn't to replace people. It is to do an action. Mm-hmm. And so it is just the one part of a person that is most useful to it, like an arm.
Yeah. So all the science fiction robots that we see are like very humanoid, usually programmed with some sort of artificial intelligence so that they can make decisions about a wide range of things. But that technology is very, very far off and doesn't exist. But a lot of our robots are just like, I've programmed this thing to sit on car seats.
I mean, you're the Robot Institute of America or whatever the organization was said it was a programmable thing, which was interesting to me because a lot of what we think of now is like robots that kind of program themselves. And in the mm-hmm. same way we can make decisions, it can use sort of like simple artificial intelligence to figure out its own decision making or its own object identification. So it in some way is doing its own programming. So it's almost like if we have that kind of artificial intelligence or even like a generalized artificial intelligence, it stops being a robot at that point and becomes something else. Sari, what is the etymology of the word robot? Because I know it's interesting, but I've forgotten.
So the word robot comes from a Slavic language, I think Czech, but or whatever they were speaking in the early 1900s, called robota. Or mm-hmm. which means forced labor, and it was coined in a play called Rossum's Universal Robots by a playwright called Karl Čapek, and it was just about mechanical men that are built to work in factory assembly lines and that rebel against their human masters, which is like
robots
classic,
are always doing that.
Yeah, robot uprising story before robots were a trope.
Yeah, I mean, it was, yes, a trope has to start somewhere.
And then Isaac Asimov used it and the word robotics in a short story. And he was a little bit more optimistic about how robots would like help out humans instead of be part of an uprising. And he was the one who came up with like the laws of robotics that robots won't harm humans and things like that.
Yeah, the great thing about the laws of robotics are that they really require a huge amount of understanding on the part of the robot, which mm-hmm. we are nowhere near. It's like, how do you know when you've harmed a human? Seems very obvious to me. I know when I'm harming a human, but boy, a robot could downright destroy you and have no idea it did it. Now it's time for one of our panelists has prepared three science facts for our education and enjoyment, but only one of those facts is real, and the rest of us have to figure out, either by deduction or a wild guess, which is the true fact. If we get it right, we get a sandbuck. If we're tricked, then Stefan will get the sandbuck. Stefan, what are your three facts?
Okay, these are three facts relating to water-based robotics. So fact number one, a UK-based hobby roboticist created a bunch of robotic versions of different swimming dinosaurs so that he could race them. Some researchers who heard about this got interested and were particularly interested in his plesiosaur robot because the plesiosaur is a little bit unique amongst animals because it has four identical flippers. And so there's been some mystery about how it moves. And so by studying his robot, they figured out how plesiosaurs move their flippers in relation to one another. That's fact number one. Number two, the modern conditions around the Great Barrier Reef have led to a population explosion in giant reef-eating sea stars, which has led to the development of a fleet of autonomous robots that can patrol the reefs, looking for these sea stars and delivering lethal injections of bile salts to kill them.
What salts?
Bile salts.
Bile, like yes. The stuff that your liver or
gallbladder.
Something. Gallbladder.
Yeah. Or fact number three. One company is taking lifeboats to the next level by turning them into autonomous firefighting watercraft that, once deployed, can automatically navigate to humans that are stranded in water, as well as fire water cannons at flames that it spots on the vessel.
So we've got fact number one, a hobby roboticist decided to race some swimming dinosaurs, and this taught us potentially how real plesiosaurs swam. Number two, there are some bad sea stars on the Great Barrier Reef, and that's led to the development of a fleet of autonomous robots that can look for and inject lethally the sea stars with bile salts, or three, a company that is taking lifeboats to the next level by turning them into autonomous firefighting watercraft that can automatically navigate to humans stranded in the water and shoot water cannons at the flames.
Not fire cannons.
Vessel.
That would not be helpful.
Shoot fire cannons. I feel like I have heard about people making like racing robots for fun. And also for science. So this one has credibility. This first one has credibility for me. That like it, one of the ways, and I have also heard about lots of like swimming robots and how we're going to figure that out.
Hmm.
But I really like the idea that like somebody was just having a fun. And then they were like, actually, can you send us your video? Because we're a little bit confused about how plesiosaurs work.
Yeah, I could totally imagine a scientist nerd like looking on a shelf and being like, oh, I have to see these dinosaurs. Wonder if I can make them move, and then doing that. Because that seems like what I would do if I was bored and had electrical engineering skills.
Yeah. Like, I don't think that I could do it, but I could imagine how someone might make a robotic plesiosaur fairly easily.
They're the ones with like the paddly kind of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they got like they got paddle fins, and they got a long tail and a long neck.
Sounds like the plot of like a Mega Man game or something to me. Doesn't sound real.
The sea star one sounds too sad and also a little bit too specific.
Are there giant reef eating sea stars? Is that a thing?
I have no idea. I know that sea stars eat all kinds of stuff, but I do not know about the sea star situation on the Great Barrier Reef.
Yeah, and I don't know if sea stars would have any need for eating like bleached coral, or if they were eating whatever is alive.
I'm sure they'd be eating the living stuff. Yeah,
like,
they'd be
whatever's left.
Yeah,
so I guess I can see a case to protect whatever's left then if there were these giant.
Do you know, Stefan, if these sea stars belong there? Are they invasive? How'd they get there?
I'm not 100% sure, but I think they do belong there.
So let's ask more specific questions about other things then.
I think I talked about some kind of algorithm that can take a census of what fish live in a reef. So maybe it's some kind of adaptation sort of that idea.
And then, I mean, an autonomous lifeboat that can rescue people and shoot water. Like that feels real, because like if it's not being done just upon hearing it, I'm like, that's not a thing. I should found an autonomous lifeboat company. Machine learning could easily know what fire looks like. That's very easy. And one of the great things about autonomous boating, like there's just less stuff to run into in the ocean.
Yeah.
On roads, like it's very easy to like leave the road, and that's a big problem. On the ocean, it's very hard to leave the ocean. All right, who's gonna guess first?
I'm gonna guess dinosaurs, just because I think it's fun.
All right, it is fun. Sam, hit me.
I might go with dinosaurs too, because I think boat seems slightly too boring to be the right answer to me.
Mm-hmm. That's true. It is a little bit boring. And I'm going to go with starfish, because I know that that is the correct answer because I've read about this.
Oh, no.
Hank is correct. It's the starfish. So there's the three major threats to the Great Barrier Reef are climate change, pollution, and these sea stars.
Yeah, they're nasty.
Yeah, so they're called the Crown of Thorns starfish, and they're one of the largest sea stars, and they're about a foot wide, and they're covered in these venomous spines. Over the past decade or so, their populations have boomed a lot because all the agricultural runoff going into that area causes these algal blooms, and the sea star larvae are eating that algae. So they are having a grand old time over there. And they had some natural predators, but we ended up overfishing those predators. So it doesn't have any like checks to its population.
Except robots.
So they do eat the corals. Once they reach like maturity, they eat the fast growing corals, I guess, which is good if you have a little bit of that, because it makes some room for the slow growing corals to establish themselves. But it's estimated that these sea stars are responsible for about 40% of the overall coral loss that we've seen. So it's a pretty big deal. Mr. Matthew Babadin, who's a professor at Queensland University of Technology, was all the way back in 2005 starting to develop these systems. And they had like sort of rudimentary vision system that could recognize the sea stars like 2/3 of the time. But at that time, they didn't have a good way to kill them. They had like some kind of lethal injection, but you had to inject all of the 20
20 arms. And so it was like really difficult to do reliably. But in 20.
And this is something that like people would do. Like divers would go down, stab 20 different legs of a starfish, and then move on to the next one.
Got one.
And it's venomous too, right? So they were trying not to get stabbed back.
Yeah, they have these like long, long stabby poles.
But by 2014, we had found this bile salt injection thing that has a 100% mortality and you only have to poke it one time. And then by that point, his vision system was capable of identifying the sea stars over 99% of the time. They went through a couple iterations, I think, but they ended up with what they're calling the Ranger Bot. When it's about a meter long, it's got a bunch of propellers so that it's really maneuverable. And I guess the battery lasts about 8 hours and it can go at night. It can go during the day. If there's a storm out, it can go anytime. And it's super easy to control. I guess they did a lot of user testing to make sure that it was user friendly. So, you know, people who are trying to save the reefs can go out and plot courses for these robots and control them. Mm. And as a bonus, it has a bunch of like sensors on it so it can monitor the reef health while it's out there looking for these sea stars and killing them. And last I had read, there were about five of them that were operational, but they're not yet widely available to different like reef management teams. But the idea is to have a bunch of these like fleets just all over the reef.
That's cool. Next up, we're going to take a break and then it'll be time for the fact off. Welcome, everybody. Sam, Buck, totals. Sari has one. I have one. Stefan has two. And Sam has none.
Objection.
Sorry, I put you in the end
Objection.
There. I don't know exactly why I did it in that order. But now it's your chance, Sam, because it's time for the Fact Off, where two panelists have brought science facts in an attempt to blow everyone else's minds. The presentees each have a Sam Buck to award to the fact that they like the most, and we will decide who goes first with this trivia question. As Sari said, the word robot first appeared in Czech playwright Karel Čapek's play, Rossum's Universal Robots. In what year did this play premiere?
Oh, no.
I'm going to say 1917.
Ooh.
I'm going to say 1904.
Oh.
Okay.
Hank wins.
Oh.
Oh no.
It was 1921.
Oh, oh nice. Okay. We were pretty close. I want to go first. Once upon a time in the old days, rich people had people put their clothes on for them. But that is still something that happens for some people who need help getting their garments on and off. And there's plenty of reasons why: age, injury, other kinds of limitations. So scientists at the Georgia Institute of Technology have gotten a robot to start to figure out how to dress a person. So they used a pre-built research robot. This is a thing that already existed called the PR2, and it can be programmed to do things like fold towels or grab drinks for people from the fridge. They wanted it to learn how to dress a person, which means you have to let it fail and make mistakes. Mm. But robots making mistakes with a real human body would be dangerous because, as we discussed earlier, robots do not know when they are killing you. So they had a robot study 11,000 simulations of a robot putting a hospital gown onto a human arm. And it had the robot analyze the kinds of forces it can apply and the motions it can make and how those forces and motions affect the person who is getting dressed. In some of those simulations, they intentionally had it go very wrong. So, like, the gown would catch on the hand or the thumb or the elbow, and to deal with it, the simulated robot would then apply a dangerous level of force to the arm. And those were given to it as intentional failure states, so it would know this is bad, this simulation went very wrong, never ever do this. So it went through 11,000 of these simulations, and it got through them in one day because it's a computer and it can do that. And then it moved on after that day to dressing people, and it was able to do that, by which I mean it was able to put one sleeve on one arm of one person. in about 10 seconds, which is like, you know, maybe not as fast as I would do it, but plenty good. Importantly here, it is using touch, so it can feel how things feel on its fingertips to figure out what the person getting dressed might be feeling. And also it's using its sight. So it's feeling and watching and using all of that information at the same time. And then from all of those movements and all the simulations and all the data it's getting, it can sort of pick the best motion for getting the arm into the sleeve, which so far so good. As of 2018, it was able to put the surgical gown on the arm of a person. Getting a person fully dressed will take more work, but we're on our way.
Yeah, it's worth it if I never have to put my own pair of pants on ever again.
It's also worth it if the robot doesn't rip your thumb off when it's trying to put your shirt on. All right, Sam, what you got for us?
All right. So one big hurdle encountered when making robots that are intended to interact with and like walk around in their environments is maneuverability. So when people and animals move around, they're balancing, they're like pathfinding, they're adjusting to changes in incline, and they're like jumping around, and they're even transitioning from like water to land to sea. And not to mention that robots run on batteries and they can't just stop and eat like a bug or a bunch of grass when they need to keep going. Not yet, at least. And there have been a lot of advances in robo-mobility, but they can't really compare to good old-fashioned flesh and bone. So researchers at the Korea Advanced Institute of Science and Technology took a kind of weird and freaky shortcut. They developed what they call a parasitic robot system that commandeers an organic being and pretty much uses them as like a horse. So their first and I think the only test subject that they've done so far were a bunch of turtles, red-eared slider turtles. They were chosen not only because they're amphibious, so there would be lots of options for the different kind of terrain they could do, but they have good memories, and they come with a big old shell that you can glue a bunch of electronic components to. So the robot is basically like a little microchip brain hooked up to a battery, and then a bank of 5 red LED lights that are mounted horizontally in front of the turtle's face, and then a little container of food that's like a gel, and a spray nozzle that they positioned near the turtle's mouth. So for 2 weeks before they started this experiment, the turtles were fed while they were looking at a red LED light. Mm. And then they put the robot on them. And the robot had instructions to move the turtles along certain paths. So to do this, it would light up one of the 5 red lights in the direction closest to the way they wanted the turtle to go. And if the turtle went the way that they wanted it to, the turtle would get a little gel treat from the robot's food tanks. So after 5 weeks of doing this, the robots were guiding the turtles through 16 feet of track in 75 seconds with a deviation from the ideal path of less than 3%. So one of the big challenges that the researchers faced was that the turtles would sometimes get distracted by stuff that wasn't the red lights in front of them. So future experiments they are planning will use full virtual reality turtle headsets to ensure that the parasitic robots have complete and total control of the turtles.
Oh my gosh.
This is way less bad than I thought it was going to be.
It's still scary,
like,
though.
I thought we were going to like be drilling holes in these poor boys' heads.
I think they just glued the things onto their shell. I don't think any holes were drilled anywhere in the turtles.
I'm very impressed that turtles are this trainable. I had never really thought about trying to train a turtle.
Yeah. I sense that I am in trouble. Do you guys want to choose between the two facts? We have 10,000 simulations, some of which were violently incorrect, leading to a robot that can put a sleeve onto a person in 10 seconds. Or Sam's amazing parasitic robot turtle. 3, 2, 1.
Sam.
Yeah, I know.
Hey. I think only because the dressing robot only got one arm. If it had gotten the other arm, I would have been like, yes. But they had complete control over these turtles.
Mm-hmm. That's right. They did.
Unless the turtle got distracted.
Yeah. Hank, you did too good at science journalism, where you were like, okay, I'm going to lower your expectations. One arm, instead of starting with a fully automated closet that dresses you, is on the way. Yeah.
And that means it's time for Ask the Science Couch, where we have some listener questions for our couch of finely honed scientific minds. At Treehouse Down asks, why is robotics skin so hard to make? Well, it depends on what you mean. So, like, just covering something in plastic is not hard. But if you want it to sense, that is very hard, it turns out. So there are, like, a number of reasons why. One, because, like, we sense many different things. And two, because, like, the nerve density of our ability to sense and then to send that information for each little bit of skin, like, it's amazing that we can do this. But if you're trying to do it with a robot, you have to have each, like, tiny bit of resolution, of skin feeling resolution, to, like, have a separate wire that connects to a frickin' central processing unit. And that is just, it's miserably difficult. So, that's one of my understandings, at least, of this.
Who is making robot skin, and why are they making robot skin?
Do you really have to ask?
Not just sex. If you want any robot to be able to... So, like, take the arm robot that has to touch someone's arm and be like, oh, I'm going to put a sleeve on this. Mm-hmm. It needs, like, touch receptors to know how much force it's putting on that arm. It needs... probably, like, temperature sensors to be like, is this a living human or a dead corpse? I don't know. That's, like, kind of a bad example, but
it's important. That's important.
You want it to understand the world around itself. So if it runs into something, you want it to know that that happened. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times right now, it just literally can't know. And if it does know, it knows that something happened, but it doesn't have any idea what it ran into or in what direction.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in the way that we have, like, spatial orientation, we know how our body is arranged relative to itself. So we, like, know our arm is to the right or to the left of our body, for example. That's all nerve endings. It's called proprioception, and it's in our muscles and our skin. And so, like, in order to have especially humanoid robots, but any robot that's doing a delicate task, you need some equivalent of skin with all these sensations to do the delicate actions. But as far as answering the question, Hank is right. It's mostly just because our skin is so dang complicated. In addition to all the wiring stuff, our skin can get damaged and still function. And that's a hard part of approximating skin. Yeah. So even if we have a cut in our skin, that doesn't mean all the nerve endings are suddenly destroyed. But if you have a cut in robotic skin, if that slashes through a sensor, that could mess up the whole system.
Right.
And so a lot of innovations in robotic skin technology are electrical engineering related and have to do with programming the electronics and the signals so that the processor that is receiving all of them doesn't get overloaded with information. There are a couple different ways that people are experimenting with it. One is called asynchronously coded electronic skin, or ACES, which I think it's similar to this other one. The way it sends signals is not all at the same time. It spaces them out in such a way that there isn't, like, a big backlog of signals, like, waiting to be processed. And then another one, it's, like, above a certain threshold of activity. So, like, if you put a hat on your head senses it. It's like, oh, that's weird. There's a hat on my head. But after a little bit of time, your head just becomes used to it unless something else changes, like you take it off. And so they're trying to program a robotic skin to mimic that. So, like, it recognizes the change in temperature or pressure and then recognizes it for a time. But then when it becomes part of the robot's state of being, you ignore it so that you can focus your processing energy on other things.
We kind of do that too. Where, like, tune things out after the signal has been there for a while.
Yeah. It's like how you don't know where your tongue is until I said that. Now you're like, oh.
I always know where my tongue is.
Sam's constantly thinking about his tongue. If you want to ask the Science Couch your questions, follow us on Twitter at @SciShowTangents, where we will tweet out the topics for upcoming episodes every week. Thank you to @CamillaVish13 and @LittleChris and everybody else who tweeted us your questions this episode. Sam Buck, final scores. Sari, you and I are tied for last with 1 point. Sam and Stefan are tied for first with two. So for the season, that brings us to Sari in the lead with 37 points, followed by 36 Stefan, 35 Sam, and 34 Hank.
Oh, no.
It's neck and neck.
Tightly packed. If you like this show and you want to help us out, it's real easy to do that. First, you can leave us a review wherever you listen. That's helpful and helps us know what you like about the show. Second, you can tweet out your favorite moment from the episode or just say nice stuff to us on Twitter. And finally, if you want to show your love for SciShow Tangents, just tell people about us. Thank you for joining us. I've been Hank Green.
I've been Sari Riley.
I've been Stefan Chin.
And I've been Sam Schultz.
SciShow Tangents is a co-production of Complexly and the wonderful team at WNYC Studios. It's created by all of us and produced by Caitlin Hoffmeister and Sam Schultz, who is also our editor. Our editorial assistant is Deboki Chakravarti. Our sound design is by Joseph Tuna Medish. Our beautiful logo is by Hiroko Matsushima. And we couldn't make any of this without our patrons on Patreon. Thank you. And remember, the mind is not a vessel to be filled, but a fire to be lighted.
But one more thing. If you were a medical student in the UK in 2016 and you needed to practice performing rectal exams, your pickings were pretty slim. In fact, there was only one person in the whole country signed up to allow med students to perform practice exams on them, which seems like kind of a problem. So...
I mean, it seems like it would either be zero or more than one.
Just one. So a team at Imperial College London got to work inventing a robot ass. The result was what looked like a disembodied butt filled with little pistons and robot arms surrounding a silicon tube that was like a rectum. And the pistons and arms would squeeze to provide different amounts of pressure to simulate rectums of all different shapes and sizes. And also simulate different diseases and complications of the prostate. So... you just have a robot butt you can dig around in now.